Her father. On his door. I don't have tape. Slip it under. Tara went to the door. Thick carpet prevented the note from going under. She tried resting it on top of the knob. It slid off. She dug in her purse, found a stick of gum left over from the flight. Desperate times called for desperate measures. She chewed the gum, stuck it on the back of the letter, and pressed it to the door. You don't know anything about the graffiti on the side of the mill? Tara called out. Hearing or your head? Alana said. What? I already gave you me answer, so I'm wondering what your problem is. Is it your hearing or your head? As Tara fumed and tried to think of a good retort, a smirk emerged on Alana's face, and she pummeled the bag even harder. The door opened and a group of women filed in wearing long black robes and carrying swords. Alana barely glanced at them. They soon spread out all over the small space, paired up and began fencing drills. What's this? Tara smiled so they'd know it was a friendly question. They're with the experimental theatre, Alana said. Da's letting them train here. It would be so much nicer if we had the room. She stopped beating the bag to look into Tara's eyes, making sure she got her point across. She was obviously supporting her father in his quest to take over the property. Tara suddenly wished she could throw her out on her ear. Come to my office tomorrow morning, Tara said. Alana's nostrils flared as she breathed heavily. What? I would like to see you in my office at the mill in the morning. Your office? The scorn in her voice was unmistakable. For now, until we find my uncle, I'm running the business. I have cookery school. What time? Not that it's any of your business, but it starts at 6:30. Now that was early. What time can you meet me then? What's this about? Your safety, for one. Alana held up her gloves. I can take care of myself. When can you meet? I finish class at 3:30 tomorrow. I'll see you in my office at 6 p.m. I suppose. Alana threw her boxing gloves into a bin. Tara watched the women fence for several minutes before she realized what was puzzling her about the actors. These were all women. There were no men. Was that Carrig's experimental angle on Hamlet? She was looking forward to meeting this man. She went outside and was about to call another cab when she remembered the bike. She stood it up and squeezed the tires, then rolled it forward and back and tested the brakes. Only when she was convinced it wasn't a death trap did she hop on and ride off. At least by now she had her bearings, and as long as she could see the bay, she knew she was headed in the right direction. This visit had been a waste. Alana hadn't told her anything new. Tara would have better luck getting the cows to talk. When Tara arrived at the mill to find another note tacked to the door, she hesitated, her mind flashing back to that first threatening note. She opened it, relieved to see handwriting as opposed to typing. The cottage has been cleaned. I'll start on the floors as soon as you let me know the material. Invoice is on Johnny's desk. Security firm coming in a few days to install cameras. Any idea why your name was written on his wall? Danny. Why on earth were so many details of the crime scene leaking out? The cleaning crew must have told Danny about her name splotched on the wall. At least the cottage had been cleaned, and soon they would have security at the mill. She would go online and look at flooring. The old floors had been wood, but nothing fancy. She would stick with wood, maybe something dark like chestnut. With a small space, you could afford to splurge a little. And when Johnny returned, she'd share her design plans, and if he approved, it would be one less thing he'd have to deal with. Unless, of course, he was guilty, and he wouldn't be seeing the inside of his cottage for a long time. Tara left a voicemail for Danny, informing him that she liked dark wood, like chestnut, for the floor, and mentioned she'd need to talk to him about accessing Johnny's finances. Danny had said Johnny wasn't a check writer, so he must get cash from his bank, or maybe he was the type to hide it under his mattress. Was anything missing from Johnny's cottage? Maybe Emmett had disturbed a burglary in progress. Hard to say when the one person who could answer that question for sure was missing. Hound was pacing in front of the office door. She got the feeling he missed Johnny, or was worried about him. It was heartbreaking. He had been fed, so she let him outside. But instead of taking off, he took a few steps, and then looked back. Apparently she was now part of his routine. You're right. A walk is just what I need. The morning mist had turned into a gentle rain. So she donned a baseball cap and rain jacket she found in a nearby closet, along with rubber boots, and then she locked up before following Hound. The dog immediately trotted in the direction of Johnny's cottage, down the cobblestone path along the bay, and Tara followed. Fishermen were still out, their little boats rocking in the rain. Hound kept a good clip, but constantly swiveled his head back to make sure she was following. By the time she reached the base of Johnny's hill, she was having second thoughts. The rain lashed out like sharp spikes, chilling her to the bone. Hound was waiting at the top of the hill, ears back and tail tucked. Tara pushed on, her feet slipping in her oversized boots, making the slog all the more cumbersome. By the time she reached the top, the dog was out of sight. Hound, she called out once, then twice. After a third time, she saw Hound move toward her, a blur of wet fur. She wished she had brought a flashlight. It was difficult to see. Hound stopped a few feet from her and whined. Now what? He turned and headed to the back of the cottage. She followed. On the other side of the hill, a patch of grass was visible, surrounded by a collection of large stones. Hound bounded forward as if the stones were alive and had just whistled for him. Before she could follow him, Hound came racing back, a piece of dark fabric clenched in his mouth. Tara bent down and coaxed him closer. When she tried to reach for it, Hound growled and skittered away. The object appeared to be a man's cap. Did it belong to Johnny? That would explain why the dog didn't want to let it go. He missed his master. Tara felt a pang of sorrow for the poor horse dog. She hurried over to the spot marked by the stones. She had to see if there was anything else to find. It was so dark. She took out her phone, grateful for the flashlight app. Near the largest stone, she found evidence of a disturbance. Dirt flung, leaves parted. The cap had probably been lying right there. She continued a little farther on, just to make sure there wasn't another dead body. Grass and dirt and stones. There was nothing more to see. She hurried away with Hound at her heels, cap clenched in his mouth. She and Hound stood in front of the Mill Street Garda station. A stone building with a blue door and ornate iron sign hanging above. They were dripping wet, probably looking like they'd been washed up from the bay and spit out onto the rocky beach. Hound had refused to give up the cap, and it took considerable coaching to get him to come inside the station. She approached a long counter, dripping water as she went, and asked for Detective Sergeant Gable. The woman behind the counter was carrying extra weight, but she had a beautiful, friendly face and a cute brunette bob. A bag of potato chips and a can of Coke sat next to her. No dogs, the woman said, sticking a chip in her mouth and flicking a look to Hound. She leaned over the counter and smiled. Even cuties like you, she crooned. Hound wagged his tail. This is my uncle's dog, Tara said. No, the woman said, plucking a chip from the bag and pointing it at Hound before plopping it into her mouth. That's Johnny Meehan's dog. Correct, the woman tilted her head. And he found this. Tara pointed to the cap. I haven't touched it. It was found near the crime scene. The young clerk put on gloves, came around the counter and knelt by the dog. She tried to remove the cap from Hound's mouth. He pulled back, ready to engage in a game of tug-of-war. It was clear he intended on being the winner. The girl sighed and stood up. "I have cats," she said. "They're easier."
"Maybe he'd give it up for one of your chips," Tara said.
"I don't have chips."
Tara pointed at the bag of potato chips.
"Oh, my crisps! Are you mental? This is my supper. You'd have to pry them out of me dead hands."
Tara laughed and the woman winked.
"Will you ring Detective Gable, let him know I'm here?"
Tara asked. The clerk smiled as if letting Tara in on a secret.
"You're American?"
Tara waited to see if there was more. There wasn't.
"Yes."
"And you say you're Johnny Meehan's niece?"
"Yes."
"You live in New York?"
Her eyes radiated excitement. Tara understood the feeling. Cities like Galway and New York got under your skin, worked their magic on you.
"I do."
She gave a wistful sigh.
"I've always wanted to go to New York."
"You should. It's a great city, although it's not too shabby around here either."
"Galway is the best city in all of Ireland. At least we think so,"
she laughed.
"I loved Irish revivals. I bought me mam a stained glass window for her birthday."
"That's nice."
Tara suddenly realised that this woman was being friendly.
"I'm Tara Meehan."
"Brianna Cunningham," she said, beaming. "Nice to meet you."
"You as well. I'm glad you like the salvage mill. I intend to keep it going."
"Hi, it's lovely. Took me ages to find what I wanted, though. Like rooting through a jungle."
She looked down at Hound, still gripping the cap in his teeth. She reached around the corner and grabbed a potato chip. She held it out in front of her.
"Okay, love. I suppose one wouldn't kill either of us. Crisp for your cap."
Hound dropped it immediately and snapped up the chip. The guard was quick. She had the cap in her gloved hand before he had even swallowed. She brought the cap closer, then shrugged as she looked at it.
"It's not a crime to find a cap."
"I'm not asking you to arrest the dog."
Brianna turned the cap over as if she hadn't heard Tara.
"Almost every Irishman around here owns a cap like this. And woman, I'd say I have one lying around somewhere myself."
She reached behind the counter again, and this time came up with a plastic bag. She dropped the cap into it, then tried to reach for Hound. He backed away.
"Shy one, is he?"
Was she not going to call Detective Gable?
"The cap was found in a patch of grass near Johnny's cottage. I need to speak with Detective Gable."
The woman nodded.
"Take the dog outside before he kills me. Humans are the only animals allowed in here. I'll send the detective sergeant out to you."
Outside, Detective Gable showed more interest in Tara's discovery than the young woman had. His gaze shifted in the direction of Johnny's cottage.
"You'll show us where he found the cap?"
Tara shivered.
"Of course."
Detective Sergeant Gable gazed out at the dark and the rain. "I wish you would have waited until the morning." There was no good reply. She nodded. He radioed in for help, and a few minutes later they were off. As they headed for the cottage, Gable used the opportunity to grill Tara.
"What time did you discover Emmett that day?"
"I headed out around 4 p.m. to find him. It must have been 5 or so in the evening."
"What time did you arrive in Galway?"
"My bus from Shannon got in around 11 in the morning."
"And you can verify that?"
"I should still have the bus ticket."
"Who else did you see when you arrived?"
She wasn't sure why he was going into all of this right now, but it was a welcome distraction from the rain.
"I ran into Danny O'Donnell."
She didn't mention that she'd also covered him in her mother's ashes.
"I saw Rose, the fortune teller."
Should she mention the woman's ominous words?
"And then Grace Quinn and Alana Kelly at the inn. That's all before I went to O'Doul's." I ran into Ben Kelly there.
Detective Sergeant Gable nodded.
I'd say you're in the clear.
How is that? She didn't want to sound like she was arguing about that, but it was obvious he had some information.
The medical examiner says he was killed at sunrise. If we can verify you were on a bus, then you're in the clear.
An early morning killer. Johnny Meehan struck her as a morning person, but she wasn't about to say that out loud. Did that cross Danny off her list? He definitely wasn't a morning person.
Why don't you take cover in the cottage?
Gable said once they arrived. It sounded like a polite suggestion, but Tara knew it was an order. She was more than happy to let the four guards go hunting around for themselves. She made her way to the cottage, grateful she had the key in her purse, and that the cottage had just been professionally cleaned. Once inside, she was relieved to see the results of the cleaning crew. The place was immaculate and smelled like lavender. The cleaning crew surpassed her expectations. She glanced at the wall where her name had been and the floor where she'd found Emmett. They were pristine. Of course, she could still feel it. Every time she glanced at the back wall, ghost letters spelled out her name in blood. Some people believed that negative energy remained in a space long after a traumatic event. She wondered if it was true. She hoped not. The jungle gym her son had fallen from had been taken down, and a Winnie the Pooh statue had been erected in his honor. Thomas had loved Winnie the Pooh. He would have outgrown that by now. She immediately stripped off her wet clothes in the tiny bathroom and found a large shirt and a robe in the back bedroom. Unlike the front room, the bedroom had not been touched, and it was a mess. The bed was unmade. Clothes were strewn on the floor and piled on the single chair in the corner. The dresser was cluttered with objects. Loose change, empty beer bottles, even potato chip wrappers. Why was he Felix in the kitchen and Oscar in the bedroom? Maybe he always needed one space that was cluttered, like his office in the mill. He would probably hate that she was here, silently judging his mess when she was the trespasser. She left the room as quickly as possible. Wow, this was weird. Borrowing clothes from an uncle she'd never met. Never mind one on the lam and suspected of being a killer. But it seemed a better alternative than walking around in her birthday suit and getting sick. Besides, if he did return, he'd have bigger things to worry about than his wardrobe. She hung her wet clothes on the racks in the bathroom and pulled the robe tight. Kindling and cut firewood were tossed into a large tin bucket near the wood-burning stove. Matchbooks were stacked in a jar on the mantel. She thumbed through them, for no other reason than in the movies. Clues were always planted in matchbooks. But she learned nothing other than Ireland had a lot of pubs, and Johnny Meehan seemed to pick up a matchbook or two from each one. Minutes later, Tara had a roaring fire. She entered the kitchen and put the kettle on. She found a mug and a tea bag. For once, she didn't care what the substance was. She was just looking for a bit of comfort. Rain and wind pounded the windows. The poor guards out in these conditions. She found a pitcher of milk in the refrigerator and a bowl of sugar next to the sink. She fixed her tea, curled up on the sofa, and stared out the front window. She had the porch light on now, so she would see the guards pass by the front of the cottage when they were done, and if they needed to speak with her, they would know she was inside. For now, she was surprisingly cozy. One might even say, at home.
Chapter 10. After drinking her mug of tea, gazing into the crackling fire and daydreaming about the ways she'd redecorate, Tara fell into a deep sleep on the sofa. It wasn't until she felt the sun on her face, shining directly in through the windows, that she realized she'd spent the entire night. She bolted upright, thinking how foolish it was to spend the night where a man had just been murdered, given the murderer was on the loose. Too late for that.
It was morning, and she was alive. Her sundress was dry, and she quickly slipped it back on and made herself another cup of tea. She took her mug outside and gazed down at the bay. Light bounced over the surface, like dancing diamonds. Tara had once seen a photography exhibit in which a woman photographed the same deli in New York City nearly every day for 20 years. The deli stayed the same as the people and seasons changed around it. Tara imagined doing the same with the Galway Bay. Every time she gazed at it, there was something new and exciting about it. It had been here long before her time on Earth, and would remain long after. She was the visitor on the planet, and for her the thought was a pleasant one. The morning air smelled crisp with just a pinch of salt. She had an urge to get to the mill and start planning her day. As she was locking the door to the cottage, she looked down to see something odd resting on the ground. A rose stem lay on the ground, stripped of the rosebud. Just the thorns. Had this been here last night? It had been too dark to see. Tara bent down and picked it up. It was deliberately left here, she was sure of it. Was it from Rose? Some kind of bizarre calling card or warning? Or was this place getting to her, sowing seeds of paranoia? Was she in danger of becoming like her uncle? She let the thorny stem lie where she found it and headed off for the mill. There was a light breeze blowing across the bay. Tara stopped for coffee and scones, and besides folks offering their polite hellos, nobody bothered her. She wondered if Grace had noticed her absence last night. What did it matter? Tara was a grown woman. She'd slept much better at the cottage than she had at the Bay Inn. Could she move into the cottage? Should she? She had no idea how long she was going to be here, and it would be nice to save the money. As she was putting the key to the mill into the lock, she thought of the key from the inn, room 301, and how there had been a splotch of dark red at the base. She had made a mental joke of it looking like dried blood. But what if it was? Who had stayed in that room last? Should she tell the police? Or was she being completely ridiculous? Grace Quinn would have a fit if Tara turned in one of her keys as evidence. That was a woman you did not want to cross. But Tara had to tell them, didn't she? She certainly didn't want to be accused of holding back evidence. Then again, who knows how long ago it happened? Hello? Tara whirled around to find an older woman in a tailored navy suit, clutching a white designer bag and blinking fake lashes. She had grey hair in a stylish bob, the kind some young girls now sported for fashion. It looked striking on this woman, who had light blue eyes like Tara. But that's where the resemblance ended. Everything else about her screamed money. Hello, Tara said with a cautious smile. Have you come to have a look around? She wasn't sure how common drop-ins were, but she wasn't against letting in a potential buyer, even if it was a tad early. The woman placed her hand over her heart as if the very thought was appalling. I've come to have a look, all right. A look at where my husband wasted all his money. A look at the type of business a murderer owns. This was Emmett's widow standing before her. Had the guards told her Johnny was the murderer? Or was she making assumptions like everyone else? Mrs. Walsh, Tara said, keeping her voice measured. I don't think my uncle murdered your husband, but I hope to prove that, and regardless, I am very, very sorry for your loss. Your uncle, she said, her eyes blinking faster. You sound American. My mother moved to New York before I was born, Tara recited. She felt as if her nationality was a handicap she constantly had to explain. I was hoping they had caught him by now. Emmett's wife looked around, as if Johnny might be hiding, waiting to ambush her. Would you like to come in? She shook her head. No, I would not. Tara nodded. The woman turned and started to head off. If you wish to sell back any of the items Emmett purchased, we'd be happy to take a look. The minute it came out of her mouth, Tara prayed the woman wouldn't take it the wrong way. Her eyes flicked over Tara, as if trying to ascertain her worth.
Will you pay the purchase price?
If I can find the records, then yes, of course. Was that bad business? She was glad Danny wasn't around to chide her. She wouldn't mind having a look around this castle that belonged now to the widow.
I have no use for junk, she said. I'll let you know.
Anytime, Tara said. Her instinct was to defend the salvage mill, insist that the items were valuable, not junk. But the woman was grieving, and it wasn't Tara's place to start an argument. A thought occurred to her. May I ask, did you find a typewriter in your husband's home? Mrs. Walsh squinted.
Are you joking me? He loved technology, owned every gadget there ever was. He didn't have a typewriter. He used laptops and iPads and smartphones.
Maybe he kept one around for decoration?
I've been through every square inch. He collected a lot of odd things. Typewriters weren't one of them. Why do you ask?
Someone left a typewritten note on the door a while back, and I wondered if it might be him.
Not a chance.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Mrs. Walsh frowned as if helpful were the last thing she wanted to be. When they find your uncle, he'd better be dead, or I'll make him wish he were.
She strode away, heels tottering on the rough terrain, backside swaying, handbag thumping against her hip. After her encounter with Emmett's wife, Tara didn't feel like conducting any more business. If she believed Mrs. Walsh, as she was inclined to, then Emmett didn't write that note. Who did? And where did it go? With everything else going on, she forgot to ask Sergeant Gable if the younger guard found it and bagged it as possible evidence. She bought her second scone of the day and found herself strolling into town. And when she realized she was near the Bay Inn, she decided it couldn't hurt to pop in and maybe somehow get another look at the key to room 301 and check on the red smudge. The check-in desk was unstaffed. Tara hurried up to her room and threw her belongings into her bag. She was grateful she'd packed light. She locked the door, then hurried down to the check-in desk. She was startled to see Grace at the bottom of the steps, as if she was waiting for her.
You didn't come home last night.
It sounded like an accusation, as if Tara were a child and Grace the stern headmaster. Tara wanted to tell her she was a grown woman, and she didn't have to answer to her. But Grace was an elderly Irish woman, and it just wasn't in Tara's nature to do that.
I had to help the guards.
Oh?
Grace's face blossomed.
What's the story?
I can't say. She didn't know whether she could or not, but she wasn't going to take the chance. Grace's gaze fell to Tara's suitcase.
Going somewhere?
Yes. I'm going to stay at the cottage.
What cottage?
Johnny's? Grace gasped.
It's a crime scene.
The guards are finished with it and a professional clean-up crew has already come through. Danny will eventually replace the floors and I'm thinking of redecorating it. It will be as good as new. Except, you know, there's possibly traumatic energy hovering around and maybe Emmett Walsh's ghost. Grace shook her head and took out her rosary. Her lips started to move in a silent prayer.
I'll need the key back,
Grace said, going behind the check-in desk.
Right. Tara set her room key on the desk.
Speaking of keys...
Yes.
Can I see the room key for 301? Grace raised an eyebrow.
Whatever for?
There's blood on the key.
There most certainly is not.
I noticed it when I first checked in. Remember, you almost gave me room 301?
Grace frowned,
then turned to the cubbyholes. She removed the key to 301 and just stared at it. Tara could tell from her expression that the red stain was still there. Tara leaned in.
I think we should look up who stayed in room 301 recently.
What if they had something to do with the murder?
Grace's head snapped up. You're my first guest in ages. This is nonsense.
Tara sighed. Then why not tell the guards? Let them figure out if it's blood and whose blood, and then we'll know for sure.
Know what for sure?
If the blood on that key has anything to do with the murder.
For all I know, you could be the killer.
Was that what she really thought? Why was she this defensive over the key? Then you'll be relieved to know the guards have cleared me of the murder. Grace didn't look convinced.
Why do you think that?
I wasn't anywhere near the cottage when Emmett was murdered. I hadn't even arrived yet.
Grace pursed her lips. What time would that be?
You'll have to ask Detective Sergeant Gable.
She wasn't going to leak information about the murder like the rest of the folks here.
Was anyone working the desk that morning?
Yes,
Grace said.
Myself and Alana.
You're sure?
Why wouldn't I be?
You said before me you hadn't had a guest in ages, so why would the two of you be behind the desk, bright and early?
Is Grace lying, giving both herself and Alana an alibi? After all, Alana had told her she had been at cookery school.
Tara stepped forward.
You sure Alana was here? Yes, I'm sure.
That's very strange.
Grace paled.
What?
Alana said she was in cookery school that morning.
Grace morphed into a child who had been caught red-handed. She began to stroke her left hand with her right.
Morning. Yes, you're right. I must have forgotten. She came to me after school in the afternoon.
Yes, I know. I was here. But you just said very specifically that you and Alana were here bright and early, standing at this desk.
And I corrected my mistake. I'm old. It's not easy.
Like an award-winning actress, she managed to paint a pitiful picture. Her shoulders drooped, as if each word she uttered was causing her to shrink.
I just thought maybe you were telling the truth and Alana was lying.
Or maybe you're both lying. But why?
Why are you asking questions? Grace said. Why don't you go do touristy things? Take a ferry to the Aran Islands? Ride the Ferris wheel at Salt Hill?
I can't, Tara said. I'm afraid of heights. Thomas must have felt as if he were up so high.
Off with you then,
Grace said. She used her hand to shoo her away. Tara felt as if she'd been slapped.
You'll call the guards about the key?
I most certainly will not.
I just want to find my uncle.
I can't help you.
Grace turned away and avoided eye contact.
Who's the plumber you called to fix the leak?
Come again?
She focused on a spot on the counter as if hypnotized by it.
Was there even a leak?
I believe you're leaking right now.
Grace didn't know a thing about the leak. Either her memory was giving her problems or she was covering for Alana.
I'm just trying to find my uncle, Tara said again, speaking softly, hoping to appeal to her sympathies.
Be careful what you wish for.
Grace's eyes remained hard. Tara nodded and turned away. After depositing her belongings in the cottage and having a spot of lunch, Tara made her way back to Rose's caravan. The door was closed. Tara wanted to knock, but then thought better of it. If Rose was telling some poor soul his or her fortune, it wouldn't help their mojo if she interrupted. Once she was back to the mill, she decided to hop on the rusty red bicycle and go to Nuns Island Experimental Theatre.
Maybe Carrick Murray would be friendly and helpful. He could tell Tara what item he had asked Irish Revivals to find for the theatre, and whether or not he received it. Nuns Island did not look like an island. The Nuns Island Experimental Theatre, a stone building with a fire engine red door, was set behind iron gates, also painted red. Between the gates and the front door, a patch of grass lay, flanked by a low stone wall. Hooded figures were fencing on the grass. In the middle of them reigned a tall, heavy-set man dressed in a black suit with a red bow tie. He shouted encouragement as the women sparred. "Hello?" His head snapped up. The women kept fencing.
"Oh, hello,"
he said in a booming voice. He followed it with a big smile, then immediately came to the stone wall to greet her. He extended his hand well before he reached her.
"Carrick Murray, director."
Tara Meehan, tourist. His grip was strong yet welcoming.
"Meehan,"
he said. She saw the light dawn in his eyes. "Johnny Meehan is my uncle."
"Well, well."
He glanced at the actors.
"Carry on or have a break. Practice your iambic pentameter. Whatever you'd like."
He hopped over the stone wall, surprisingly graceful for a man of his size.
"Why don't we go inside the theatre? They're allowing us use of it for this very special production."
"Wonderful." They rounded to the front of the theatre and passed through the red iron gates. Soon they were in the simple yet functional theatre. The seats were the typical folding type on an incline, but instead of red, they were blue. As a designer, Tara would have liked the seats to match the door and the gates, but she wasn't here for work. She sat in an aisle seat and Carrick took the one on the aisle across from her. He clasped his hands.
"I've heard it's been quite a trying visit for you. I'm so sorry."
"Thank you." He shook his head.
"I've known Johnny Meehan a long time. I'm sure he didn't do it."
"Really?"
"You sound surprised."
"Everyone else thinks it's possible."
"What do you think?"
"I couldn't say. I never even met him." Carrick nodded.
"He wasn't a perfect man." "Who is?"
He threw his hands up in the air.
"As a man of the theatre, I know the complexities we all hide inside. No man is a total saint, nor a total sinner. But a murderer? There's not a chance."
He crossed one leg over the other and folded his hands on top of his knees. He looked the part of a giant stuffed in a child's seat. "I'm so relieved you think he's innocent," Tara said.
"Well, I suppose there's a chance. It's always the one you least suspect, isn't it? I would have never suspected him. It's quite confounding. In my line of work, I have become an excellent judge of character. A connoisseur of human nature, if you will. Johnny Meehan, a murderer? Well, I just don't see it. Although it's always good to go against typecasting. Now that I think of it, he could very well be our killer."
A light shone in his eyes, and for a second, it was as if he had forgotten Tara was even there.
"How can I help?"
"I found a note my uncle scribbled on one of his to-do lists. Your name is mentioned. Danny thought maybe my uncle was trying to find a particular item for your theatre." He nodded, then stood.
"Follow me."
He led her out of the theatre into the grounds in the back. Here she could see the remnants of an old church.
"The Order of the Poor Clare Nuns," he said. "Two are buried there."
"I've heard a bit about them." They walked past the remains of the church. In a small clearing near it was a stone slab. The face of a man was carved into it.
"Isn't it remarkable?"
Carrick said. Tara didn't know what to say. "It's quirky."
"It's from the 15th century.
"Wow." Carrick grinned.
and there's a female slab just like this.
Ah, she knew where he was going. And you asked Johnny to find it for you?
In a manner of speaking.
I don't understand.
A friend of mine would love the female mate to this granite slab. In exchange, he was going to do a swap with me. I did ask Johnny to keep his eyes and ears open.
He nodded to the stone slab. About a week ago, he called me and said he had a lead. I was so excited. And then, well,
you know yourself. I don't suppose you know anything about it.
No, Tara said. I'll check the warehouse for you.
This makes three missing items. What was going on? Although this time Johnny didn't say he had the item, he said he had a lead on the item. This was all so frustrating. Carrig glanced at the actors huddled in the yard.
I know you're busy, Tara said. Thank you for your time. I'll keep an eye out for this lab.
I doubt I've been much help.
Carrig began to walk her back to the gate. On the wall next to it, a theatrical poster hung by the door. Hamlet screamed across the top in red. Below it was a hooded figure with just the eyes peering out. With a twist, was written in red below. Carrig noticed her reading it.
You should come. The twist will blow you away.
In addition to the all-female cast?
Carrig's face fell.
Well, I guess the twist will only blow some folks away.
Sorry. I noticed them rehearsing in the Ring of Kelly and now here. Your secret is safe with me.
A female Hamlet,
he said, as if she were still in the dark.
Wonderful.
He stared at her, as if he were still not pleased with her reaction. She mustered up some enthusiasm.
To be or not to be, she said.
Exactly, exactly.
He grinned.
To be or not to be a woman.
Ah, Tara said. Plenty of drama.
Correct. Estrogen will be the undercurrent that will run through the entire play, making it sing electric.
Tara's jaw was getting sore from smiling, not to mention her neck from nodding.
What was the item you wanted to swap for the stone slab?
Carrig stared into the distance as if the object had just materialized over the River Corrib.
A rare theatre light. An enormous globe held up by ornate wrought iron. I acquired it ages ago, but was forced to sell it when times were lean. I sold it to a friend of mine on the condition that I would buy it back some day. With interest, of course. He knew it was temporary. It seems he's grown fond of it. Refuses to give it back, or he's not really much of a friend.
Tara took notes.
What's his name?
I'm afraid I don't give out private information about my friends. That would be a sure way to lose them.
I'm just wondering if Johnny paid him a visit.
Perhaps the guards will figure it out.
Her uncle had written Inish Moore in his notebook. Is that where this friend lived? Did his name start with a D?
Did you ask your friend if Johnny came to see him?
No.
He gestured to the actors who, upon seeing him, had resumed their fencing practice. Every once in a while a grunt rang out as they parried and sparred and thrusted, or whatever the fencing lingo was.
I've been very busy.
When did Johnny come to see you?
Might have to check my calendar. But it was over a month ago.
Do you know what this D might stand for?
Tara held out her notes.
Carrig squinted, then patted his pockets.
I don't have my glasses, I'm afraid, without them. I have blindness of bat.
He smiled at his turn of phrase.
It says Inish Moore, but then he wrote the letter D.
Perhaps it's a G.
Does his friend's name start with a G? You think it's a G?
His eyes darted around.
I have no idea.
Now that he knew his play was no longer the focus of her visit, he was starting to tire of her.
Is there anything else you can tell me? She asked.
Like what?
How did my uncle seem?
Grand.
Carrick's eyes darted away from her. Was he avoiding her gaze? Maybe Johnny wasn't grand, but for some reason Carrick didn't want to admit it. Was he acting, I don't know, paranoid or angry? Carrick tugged at his bow tie as if it was cutting off his oxygen. He removed a handkerchief from his pocket and patted his brow.
No.
A pained smile broke over his face. For a connoisseur of human behaviour, he wasn't a very good liar. She waited to see if there was more. There wasn't. I'm just trying to find out what really happened. Carrick Murray smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes.
I'd be happy to comp you a seat for our production. Unless you're going home soon.
The last bit sounded hopeful. She was never going to be wanted around here, especially if she continued to go around interrogating everyone. But how else was she supposed to find her uncle? I'll have to see.
Well, if you're here for opening night, do let me know what you think.
He gave her a little bow and headed back through the iron gates. She was halfway down the path when she realized she'd left her purse inside the theatre, on the floor near her seat. She hurried back in. As she entered and headed for the seat, she could hear Carrick's voice somewhere backstage, raised in anger.
What do you think I told her? Nothing, George. Absolutely nothing. Exactly what you're going to tell her if she comes to see you.
Tara froze. He had to be talking about her. Was George the mysterious friend? Perhaps it is a G. Well, that was one mystery solved, and he was calling him literally the second she left. Why? She was debating what to do when suddenly he bolted on stage and then stopped when he spotted her. His face was scarlet. He looked at her, then his phone.
Were you eavesdropping?
No. No, I left my purse. Tara pointed at it like an idiot. He held up his phone.
That wasn't about you. It was a personal matter.
Tara snatched her purse and slung it over her shoulder. I didn't hear a thing. She turned to go.
You shouldn't go sneaking up on people.
I told you I was getting my purse.
This is a welcoming place, he said. Until it's not.
Yes, she said. I'm beginning to realize that. She let the door slam behind her. Chapter 11. The fishing trawler bobbed out in the water, and whenever Danny cast his line, the boat tipped, and Tara thought for sure she was going to be thrown overboard. Each time she screamed and he laughed. She had already read that Aran jumpers, or sweaters, as she called them, used to be stitched with the colours and patterns of specific families, and that was so they could identify fishermen's bodies when they died at sea. Maybe coming out here hadn't been such a great idea. She had found Danny at the dock, preparing to go out, when she started badgering him with questions about Carrick. He had insisted she tag along. Every time she tried to talk, he shushed her.
This is fishing.
Fishing is like meditation.
There's no jibber-jabber.
Finally, he forced her to take a fishing rod and told her he'd only answer her questions if she caught a fish. Ridiculous. Now here she was in this rickety little boat, willing herself to catch a fish. She had to admit, the rocking and the silence, and the waiting, were somewhat calming. Danny had caught 3 fish already, silver floppy things that thrashed in the bottom of the boat until he tossed them in the cooler resting in the middle and shut the lid.
Salmon,
Danny said with delight.
This will be grand for supper.
Tara winced. Danny gave her a side glance.
You're a sensitive one.
It's hard to watch anything die, she said. If only everyone in the city felt the same.
It's easier when they're on your plate with a pint of Guinness, he winked.
I'm sure it is.
You'll see, Tonight.
She raised her eyebrow. He nodded to the cooler.
As I said, this is supper.
You really not going to answer my questions until I catch a fish? He had already told her he had no idea who this George might be. After that, he laid down the no talking until she caught a fish rule. She was having a hard time playing by it. He put his finger to his lips. She laughed, then gazed back out at the water.
That a girl, she heard him say.
A warmth flooded through her. Ladies' man. She would have to watch herself. She was nearly falling asleep when she felt a tug on her line. She jolted and pulled on the rod. Something's there.
Easy now.
Suddenly he was behind her, his arms around her, holding onto the rod with her.
Give it a tug,
she tugged.
Reel him in.
She started to rotate the crank. Danny fell back.
That's it. Keep going.
This was kind of exciting. The closer it got, the harder it was to reel in. Her tongue was hanging out the corner of her mouth as she turned the handle. Her breath labored.
Come on, little fish,
she said.
I think it's a big one,
Danny said. The line jerked, nearly knocking Tara over. She thrashed, refusing to let go, and put all her strength into reeling it in. Finally, she could see its head cresting out of the water, the sun bouncing off its shiny gills, making it look like it was showered in glitter.
That's one good-looking salmon,
Danny said. Tara had an urge to throw it back, save its life. But then she imagined it on her plate, a pint of Guinness next to it, along with a heap of potatoes. When would she ever get the chance to catch another one like it? It is big, isn't it? Tara said. Danny whooped and high-fived her. A nearby fisherman heard their excitement. He rowed close enough to reveal a gap between his teeth.
Looks like you had better luck than me.
He stared longingly at their cooler.
No catches?
Danny asked.
We didn't say that.
The man reached into the boat and hauled something up.
Tell me, what am I going to do with this?
His catch sat in the palm of his hand. It was a cast iron animal head. The body was missing. Green patina was visible around the ears. Its snout was open in laughter. The fisherman laughed.
Not every day you catch a little piggy now, is it?
Danny called the guards, and by the time he had finished mooring and securing the boat, Detective Sergeant Gable was waiting on shore with an evidence bag.
Do you think it's the murder weapon?
Danny asked.
I think there must be a reason someone rowed out to sea and tossed it in,
Detective Gable said.
We'll send a team in to search for the rest of it.
He gazed out at the bay. Had Johnny escaped by boat? Did Johnny own a boat? Tara wondered out loud. Danny and Detective Gable both snapped to attention. She was happy for a moment that she'd thought of something they hadn't. Detective Gable looked at Danny.
Do you know where he kept it?
Danny nodded and started down the dock.
This way.
They followed him past 10 slips with boats snugged into them, where he stood looking at the only empty space on the dock.
It's gone.
Detective Sergeant Gable was the first to state the obvious.
It is indeed, Danny said.
The two of them lifted their faces to the bay. Tara could see what they were imagining. Johnny Meehan hitting Emmett over the head with a cast-iron pig, fleeing down to his boat, rowing the murder weapon out to sea and tossing it in. And then what? Did he keep going? Or were he and his little boat out there somewhere, lost, or worse, buried at sea? Danny was right about one thing. There was nothing like fresh-caught salmon and a good pint of Guinness. He had prepared the entire meal at his place, which also included potatoes and veg, but instead of inviting her over, he brought it all over to the cottage. Tara set up the tiny kitchen table, already thinking if she had her way, she would replace it with something new, maybe a built-in breakfast bar. But this wasn't her cottage, so she would only go as far as imagining and pricing the possible renovations until her uncle returned and could be consulted. Tara had just taken her last bite of salmon when something sharp poked the side of her mouth. It felt like a knife. She cried out and spit the offending object into her hand. In her palm sat a jagged shard of broken glass. If she had accidentally swallowed it, she could have choked to death on it.
"Oh my God,"
Danny said. He jumped up from the table and stared at the shard in her hand. He shook his head.
"I don't know where that came from."
"It came from the piece of fish you cooked," she said slowly. A red flush crept up his face.
"I didn't cook it."
Tara shot out of her chair.
"Who did?"
But she knew. From the shade of scarlet his face turned.
"Alana?"
"She's studying cookery. She offered."
"I bet she did. I wanted it to be special. Your first catch and all."
Tara could only imagine how Alana felt about that. Or maybe she didn't have to. She held up the piece of glass.
"What do you think happened here?"
Danny shook his head.
"I'm sure it was an accident."
Tara glanced at the pan Danny had brought the fish in. He'd only brought two large pieces.
"Did she ask you which piece you intended on giving to me?"
His face remained still as he mulled over the implication of her question. He shook his head.
"You can't think she did it on purpose. I probably put her under the gun."
He snapped his fingers.
"She was drinking a glass of wine while she cooked. Maybe it broke."
"I'll ask her.
But please, don't go around accusing her of trying to murder you with a piece of salmon."
"Did she cook it at your place or her dad's?"
"No, no, her flat at the mill."
"Were you there?"
Danny sighed.
"I was downstairs."
"Then how did you know she was drinking a glass of wine?"
"I brought the salmon up to her flat, and when she opened the door, she was holding a glass of wine."
"I bet she was."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
It was now or never.
"You know she's in love with you."
"What are you trying to say?"
She noted he was no longer denying it.
"You don't ask a woman who's in love with you for favors, especially if that favor is cooking dinner for another woman."
Tara set the piece of glass on the table.
"Did she know she was making this for me?"
Danny dropped his head. Did this give Tara a reason to search Alana's room? Probably not. Danny stood and began to pace.
"It was an accident.
Or she tried to kill me."
"She couldn't have known you were going to eat that piece. It could have been me. And according to you, she's in love with me."
"You know she is.
Which means it was an accident."
Tara sighed.
"I hope you're right."
"I am. I'll talk to her. If I think there's anything fishy about this, I'll tell you." Tara laughed, despite the uneasy feeling gnawing at her.
"Very funny."
He reached for a bottle of whiskey on the counter.
"How about a nip?"
Tara accepted. They took their nips of whiskey over to the sofa near the fire. Once again, Tara brought up her meeting with Carrig Murray. This time, he listened intently.
"You're saying two other items are missing?"
"Yes. We've located the pig now, but there's also a cast iron harp he promised Grace Quinn, and a stone slab with the face of a woman that, whoever this D or G is, maybe George?" She sighed.
"Do you think he threw those out to sea as well?"
Danny frowned.
"Why is Carrig being so secretive?"
"Nobody here likes me."
"He said this friend.
Presumably George owned something that once belonged to him?" Tara nodded. "An old theatre light. Does that ring any bells?"
"Neither rings any bells nor lights any bulbs," Danny said.
But people were always asking Johnny for things. I'd say he's bought something for nearly every local in Galway at one point or the other. Not sure how any of it will help us find Johnny. Could Johnny have rowed all the way out to Inishmore? Danny contemplated this. It's not just the bay you're crossing, but the ocean. It can be rough enough in the commuter ferries. Johnny liked to fish like the lot of us around here, but he wasn't one of the professionals. If Johnny tried to row his boat over to the Aran Islands... He let the sentence hang. But we know Johnny was thinking of going there before he disappeared. That's something, at least. She thought of Alana's room above the mill. Does Johnny have a key for the upstairs flat? Alana's flat? Technically, it wasn't hers. It was Johnny's. Yes. Why? She sighed. Danny seemed protective of Alana. Grace Quinn said that Johnny thought Alana might have been stealing from him. And you want to break into her room and find out? It's not breaking in if you have a key. It's trespassing. It wasn't a sliver of glass. It was a shard. An accident, Danny repeated. I'd bet me life on it. It's not just that. She seems pretty hostile. Like her father. She can be a bit moody, all right. She's a woman, isn't she? He flashed a grin. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Are you saying I scorned her? Tara simply stared at him. Listen, you've got the wrong end of the stick. He ran his fingers through his hair. Then give me the right end. He groaned. I hate to talk out of school. Whatever he had to say, he didn't relish spilling secrets. Tara liked that about him. It won't leave this room, Tara said, unless I feel someone is in danger. Alana wasn't cooking alone. I believe she was on a date. This was news. With who? Hamlet. Hamlet? Correct, as in the actress who plays Hamlet. Oh, yes, Danny said with a wink. I'm back to being unloved. His grin was back. Tara could have sworn that Alana was in love with Danny. Why are you assuming it was a date? Just a feeling. Besides, why on earth would she want to steal architectural items from the place where she lives? What if she was trying to drive Johnny out?